break into some dance moves, which would be really embarrassing for me. Well, you know, the green light's just staying on now on this. Oh, I know. You have to just throw it on the floor and smash it to turn it off. I'll put that up. But what I think it says is that fathers are really critical in the welfare and development of their children. Both men and women, and I'll talk about both young men and young women, I'll talk about both of those this morning at different times. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 6 says this: grandchildren are the crown of old men, and the glory of sons is their fathers. The glory of sons is their fathers. 20 years ago, the Tampa Tribune published a statement by Dr. Benjamin Spock, and here it is. He said, "Instability of marriage and family, cruel competitiveness in business, sports, and education, racial and ethnic divisiveness, materialism run rampant with no spiritual or ethical values to offset it, increasing violence, a coarsening of our attitude toward sex, a lack of high energy daycare, an educational system that spews out children with no skills, no goals, and no preparation for satisfying lives. Tote it up, and you have a picture of a society speeding downhill." Interesting that he would say that, because many of us would say he's part of the reason for some of that in his books on child care and rearing children. But I do think that he is indicating for us the challenge that we face in being godly fathers in a world where nobody seems to value that role. And you would think that we would see the connection between the results of fatherless homes and the value of fathers, but that really hasn't dawned on anybody yet, and everything under the sun is being positioned as the reason for those problems, except the one that we know. People aren't living by God's plan. And that's what we got to do. So I realize I'm speaking to basically four groups here. There are those young men who have no family yet, maybe married with no children, or not even married yet. And you brothers have been prayed for very well this morning. But I think probably the things that I'll talk about, something might resonate with you and it might lodge itself in your heart or mind and be used down the road. And there are those, the obvious group, those who have children and are looking for help. We all are. I mean, this is one of those jobs that, as we realize the parameters and the breadth of raising children, we're all looking for any of the help that we can get. The third group is that group of people who've raised their children, and you may be thinking, I'm done with that. I guess what I'm here for is just to find out how well I did. But I would suggest to you that there's a deeper role for you. And it is in some ways the same role that I would offer to those who do not have children and either by design or by necessity will not have children. You won't marry, you'll live a single life. And there is a great ministry for those who choose to live that life or who by circumstances are forced to live that life. There's a great ministry for the single. But for those of you who are in that situation and those who are in my situation, I would say this. There are a host of children who need proxy parents, who need a man in their lives. And I'll tell you, God smiles on those of us who pick up those children and take them to lunch or take them out to a park or take them to a movie who either relieve those single mothers for a little while of that responsibility, or who mentor them, who take those small children and put them next to you in worship services, and put your arms around them and show them how to worship and how to love God. May your tribe increase. There is such a need for that. Don't neglect that ministry, brothers. Your grandchildren need you. They need to see your example. This passage we just read, that talking about the grandfathers and the part that they play, that grandchildren are a crown of old men, and the glory of sons is their fathers. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 4, I want to direct you to a passage that will begin in earnest our discussion this morning. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. Realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. Now listen to this listing. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Now, pause there, because when you read that, I'm going to tell you something. If you want to know what you ought to be doing with your children in parenting them, just take this list and make it your attack points. I'm going to raise children who are loving. I'm going to raise children who know how malicious gossip can be, and they're not going to be gossips. And they're not going to see it in me. I'm going to raise children who are reconcilable. You can take that list and go down that list and just say, here is our task to make sure our children are not these things. Because these things characterize our culture. But what really is amazing about this, you might think, well, this is talking about the world out there. But when you come to verse 5, it says, holding to a form of godliness, but they've denied its power. They hold to a form of godliness. I'm telling you, these people are among us. This is not out there. This is what the world is like when it doesn't have Christ. Paul is telling Timothy, this is going to be the result in our family, our fellowship, if we don't do something about that. So I think it's important for us to think about these lovers of self. I don't want to raise children who are lovers of self. I don't want to raise children who are constantly looking out for themselves and not other people. I don't want to raise children who love money. But I'm going to tell you something, brothers. We set the tones in our family. And if these things characterize us, it's going to be difficult for us to convince our children that that's not what we want for them. Read this recently, and I think it's a pretty succinct summary of what we're called upon to do. Your talk talks, and your walk talks. But your walk should out-talk your talk. I'm going to say that again. Listen, your talk talks. What you say matters. And your walk, how you live, talks to your children. But the walk has to out-talk the talk. what we say is not going to be as impactful for our children as the way we walk. So we can tell them, for example, just picking up one of these, we can tell them you need to have self-control. Hey, you got to control yourself. But if we drive like maniacs, shake our fists at everybody, hit the horn every time somebody doesn't do what we want, throw our hands up and scream and holler because we can't deal with the traffic, our walk is out talking our talk. And we can tell them not to be lovers of money or lovers of pleasure. But if we make decisions that indicate we love money or we love pleasure more than we love God, that's going to talk more loudly than what we say in those circumstances. It is absolutely critical for us to know our children if we're going to rear them. To know what of these list of problems are theirs, because it's not true of every child that there'll be all these things. But to know what are the proclivities my children have. Some children have more difficulty getting control of themselves. Some are more self-centered. Some are unloving. Some have difficulty reconciling when they're in situations. You got to know that. The psalmist said that children are the arrows in our quiver. You know, you can't fire an arrow without understanding how that works. And you don't do that haphazardly and hit targets. It's important for us as men to understand our arrows, to know how they work and which ones are used for what things. It's critical to know that. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, it says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath." Now, I'm going to ask you to share with me now, just for a few minutes, out loud, what things make you really mad? Just share a couple, one thing, and a few of you share. What really makes you mad? What hits your hot button? What ticks you off more than anything else? Disrespect. Okay? These don't all have to be justifiable things, by the way. Okay? That one is. But they don't all have to be. It may be just some quirk you have or something. What did I say? Lying? Tell me one. Back in the back. Selfishness. Hey, y'all are all staying on the good things. You know, we're all saying, yeah, those are good things. Go, somebody come on, be brave. Give me one that we'll all go, really? Getting a speeding ticket. Okay, that really makes you mad. I know the solution to that. In the green. Oh, good. Okay, somebody slamming a door. Now you're cooking with gas, guys. Yeah, these are the ones. You know, leaving a shopping cart out in the middle of the mall where you or the parking lot where it's difficult for other people to park their cars or get them banged up. Josh? Some people have difficulty with that. I'm fine. When I'm supposed to be using a microphone and it doesn't work. That's funny. What else? I saw some other hands. Yeah. 35 miles an hour in a 45 mile an hour zone, it's time to turn your vehicle into a bumper car. You know, yeah, some of us feel that way. Somebody driving 55 in a 45 mile an hour zone. You guys don't need to be on the same road. Avoid each other. Avoid each other as much as you can. Yeah, Brent. Interrupting. Okay, you don't like that. That really ticks you off. You know, yeah, I'll tell you what. That technology has changed the way we view people. It used to be if you saw somebody walking down the street gesticulating and talking, you'd say, avoid them. They're strange. Something's wrong with them. And now you just find out they're just talking on the phone. Be careful if you're in a bathroom and in a stall. If the person next to you says hello, Don't answer them. I'm just saying. Don't answer them. You get called a fool, I hear. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Talking too loud on the phone. All right. I'm going to take three more from people I haven't heard from. Back there with the glasses on top. Being what? Cut off. In traffic. In traffic. Yeah. Yeah, that's when you wish you're packing. Back in the blue. You know, in the blue here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they break something? Doing something stupid. Oh, I have a story. I got to tell you a story about that. My father bought for his work walkie-talkies, you know. And they were, at this time, they were the real big ones, you know. They real big things with long antennas. And he brought them home brand new from work. My father never yelled. Never. I never heard my father raise his voice and yell. So I said, Dad, can me and my friends take the walkie-talkies out and just play with them in the yard? And he said, no, you can't, because you'll break the antennas on them. And I said, no, we won't. We won't even run. We'll just walk. Walkie-talkie. And he said, I want you to be careful with them. And I said, don't worry, we will. And we were trying to hide from each other and find each other. And I got a little carried away and excited, thinking the other guy was going to catch up with me. And you know what I did? I ran around the corner of the house and snapped the antenna off. So I went in the house, and my father was sitting in a recliner watching TV. And I walked up to him, and I laid the walkie-talkie in his lap and put the antenna next to it. And he looked down at it in his lap, and he looked back up at the TV, and he said, run. And I said, sir? And he said, run. And I said, why? He said, because if I catch you, I'm going to kill you. And I ran. I was halfway down the block. He never moved. But I was halfway down the block. He terrified me. But yeah, somebody breaks something being stupid. I sure was that person. Well, here's my point in that. There are a few of the early ones were things that probably all of us would say, I do get angry at that. But some of those others, the shopping cart or the person driving fast or driving too slow, or some of those other things that were mentioned interrupting, some of you may say, yeah, that makes me mad. But a lot of us would say, that doesn't make me mad. Now, here's my point. If fathers are not to provoke their children to wrath, or as one version puts it, exasperate your children, in order for you to do that, brothers, you better know what exasperates them. And it's not the same for every child. Every child is different about that. One child is bothered by one thing, and another child accepts that readily. One child gets really upset and irritated because our personalities are different. You just showed that. If that's true for us, that's true for our children. And while there is a sense in which we want to be fair with our children, we want to be fair and we want to be equally training all of them, if you don't want to exasperate them, you better know what their hot buttons are. You know what yours are, and you know what your wife's are, and you know how to push them, and she knows how to push yours. Know what your children's hot buttons are. Know what really irritates them. And so I think it's really important to know your children. You'll learn that from a very early age. Because you can't train or teach them very effectively if you don't know them and if you haven't earned their trust. If they sense, you know what works for me and what doesn't work for me, you've taken the time to learn that, because that doesn't come naturally for us. I think it does for our wives. I think our wives have that relational connection that we talked about a little bit last night that we don't have. We have to work at that more if we're going to be the kind of fathers, grandfathers, and mentors that we need to be for children. And that's difficult for us because it takes time. And for us, for our wives, in many cases, this is what they do. But we see ourselves largely as these hunter-gatherers, providers. We go out and work, and when we come home, we're ready to kind of relax and not continue managing like we have managed our jobs, managing our children. And I know that takes time, and it takes resources. I'll tell you what else it takes that doesn't come natural for us: transparency and openness. For most men, that's not a natural thing. Why? Well, it goes back to the competitiveness that is naturally ours. We are competitive. We were made that way. I see that in my grandchildren like I never saw it in my rearing and my daughters. But we as men are naturally competitive. And I see that in games. My wife just frustrates me no end. We're playing a game and I'm on the verge of winning, and that's a big deal to me. And she just decides, I'm tired of playing this game, and she throws it. I mean, she'll just give all of her money in a Monopoly game to somebody else on the table. And you know what my word? That's not fair. That's not fair. She said, I can do what I want. It's my money. There's nothing in the rules says I can't give it away or not collect rent. They landed on your property with hotels. You're supposed to charge them rent. I didn't see it. Well, I saw it, and I'm telling you, I'm not going to charge them. You can stay there, she'll say. We have this competitiveness as men, and I see that in my grandchildren. The other day, I was sitting in a chair, and I'm picking up some rocks, and I was flipping them with my thumb, just casually flipping the rocks out away from me. And one of my grandsons, who's 8 years old, came up, and he started picking them up and watching me, and he started flipping them. And in a minute, he went, mine went farther than yours. I thought, I wouldn't play in that. But I am now. Yeah, top that. You know, that comes out in us. We do that eating. Who can eat fastest? You know, little girls will play that for a little while, but they're not going to play that game for long. Little boys will eat a whole meal that way. Who can eat the most? Who can eat the fastest? Who drank the quickest? Who blew the biggest bubbles in their milk? They'll do that kind of thing because we are naturally competitive as part of our aggression, and that comes back to our need to provide. It all comes back to what we are. So that's not necessarily bad that we're that way. But we have to understand that that's the situation that we're facing with our children. It's different. It's different because of gender. It is different because of age. I'm going to tell you, it's different because of birth order. If you've not read the birth order book by Kevin Lehman, you need to read that book. Man, I'm telling you, I had three girls, and they are classic birth order children. My oldest daughter is driven in her life. I mean, she wants things in control. Circumstances, she wants to make sure everything is clean and neat and put away, and she feels responsibility for other people. She's not afraid to tell somebody, you probably should go somewhere else and get a haircut. That's not a good cut for you. And that's somebody she's never met before. She's not afraid to do that because she has that birth order first child syndrome. My middle daughter is the great conciliatory person. She's always looking to make things work between everybody else. My youngest daughter is the classic youngest child. You know, she has all those symptoms that younger children have. Somewhat a sense of entitlement, somewhat a sense of her own worth, and all those things happen with children. That is classic. If you're an oldest child, you know what I'm talking about. If you're a baby in the family, you know what I'm talking about. Those are things we all, and the babies want to exercise their independence and show, I'm on my own, I can take care of this. How you raise your children, all of those things make a difference Don't exasperate your children. You exasperate them when you do not understand them and you don't treat them like they need to be treated. So I was thinking about Jesus and his disciples, because in some ways what Jesus was trying to do with the disciples is what we try to do with our children. Jesus was trying to bring the disciples along to be followers of God in a deeper way than they had been before. And I think if I can tell you, the primary goal of being fathers for us is to raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Not to make them good Americans or good citizens in whatever country they're in, but to make them good followers of Jesus Christ and citizens in the kingdom of heaven. So some of the things that I see Jesus doing with the disciples, I think we need to mimic and imitate as being fathers. For example, his relationship with them was more than just companionship, and it was more than living through them vicariously. His relationship with them was investing his life in them. Now, I'm going to just ask you a question, not answer it. I don't want you to answer it out loud. But would you say your children perceive that you invest your life in them? Or that they are simply one cog in the greater wheel of what you're trying to accomplish in your life? Whether you decided to become a father and you purposely chose the time to initiate fatherhood, or whether it came upon you, you know how it happens, and you've taken on a responsibility by your actions that God expects you to carry out. And by that I mean, now you're a father, God expects you to act like one. And in the same way that Jesus took these disciples and said, "You're now mine, I bring you to me, and I want you to understand what God has for you." In that same way, we take our children and do that. We have a longer period of time to do that, but we have nonetheless the responsibility to bring them along like that. So how did he do that? Think about it. How did Jesus do that? And primarily, it was by just living among them and letting them see how he lived. I think being a father is far more a matter of being exemplary than it is of being an instructor. I know that there are times when my father and my mother sat down and told me things, but far more important was that they showed me things. My dad, by the way he lived, by the things that mattered to him, and the things that didn't matter to him, I learned. I watched, and I valued what he valued because I knew he lived his life for Jesus Christ. I'm telling you, folks, that's the way we got to be, brothers. We have got to be men who model the kind of life we want from our children. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail about this particular point, but let me just suggest this to you. When David makes a statement, "I was glad when they said to me, 'Let's go to the house of the Lord,'" I think one of those areas where we really need to model for our children what we want them to be and how we worship God. And I say that to you men because I'm more likely to see women who are emotionally involved in worship than men. I think partly because women tend to demonstrate their emotional aspects more readily than we men do. But if we want our children to be excited about worshiping God, we need to think about how we demonstrate that. Not the way we talk about it, not the way we preach about it, but the way we live that when we worship. I remember a guy in our Toastmasters club who got up to give a speech, and he started it this way. Here's what he said, just this way. I am so excited to be talking about this subject today. And when his evaluator got up and evaluated him, the first thing he said is, your words said you were excited. Nothing in your body or inflection or face said that. So here's what I'm saying to you. When we come to worship God and we sing songs like we sang this morning, how are you singing? Because your kids or your grandchildren are watching you. So what are you demonstrating in that? And don't tell me that, well, I may not show a lot of excitement here because I just never show excitement, but almost all of us have something that we get really excited and animated about. And I will tell you, if it's football or sports, or if it's politics, or if it's the business world, or if it's some other hobby you have, and you get really animated when you talk about that, I'm going to ask you, why wouldn't you be at least that excited about worshiping the God of the universe? So you want your children to verify things in the Bible? Open your Bible. You want your children to sing with the spirit and the understanding? Sing with the spirit and the understanding. You want your children to hear actively what is being said? Nod your heads. Say amen. Show some indication. Yeah, that's true. That's good. I appreciate that statement. That's worth hearing. If that's what you want from your children, then that's what you've got to model in your own life. So instead of, come on, we got to go to church. I mean, I don't know anybody that would say, come on, we got to go to Disney World. I don't know anybody that would say that. Why would we demonstrate that kind of attitude about the most important encounter our children are going to have with Jesus Christ and his people? So we need to play with our children. We need to let our children see us in our workplace. We need to teach them. And it's interesting, you know the passage, so I'm not going to go back there, but in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and you need to look at that and meditate on it and think about it again. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 7 through 9, it says, and you shall teach these things diligently to your children. And then Moses goes on to say, you'll teach them when you rise up and when you lie down, when you go out and when you come in. Notice that. That's not when they do that. It's when you do that. It doesn't say you teach it to them when they lie down. Okay, time for our bedtime story. Although that's a fine thing to do. But that you are teaching them by actions in your life. By the things that you demonstrate, by the things that you do. And so by taking them with us and putting them in the car, and not just driving them to their events, but taking them to things we do and introducing them to our friends and to our workplace, that's how we model the things that we're trying to give to our children. We are naturally action-oriented. We're not necessarily relationally oriented as men. Relationships aren't as readily desirable for us or important to us like action is. We are men. We are men, and that means we're action-oriented. But we've got to develop those relationships with our children. It's important for us to do that, so that we can model the kind of life. So pay attention to each one of them. You know, I like the way Jesus treated 70 people differently than he did the larger group of his disciples. And out of the 70, there were 12 that he developed an even closer relationship with. And there were 3 of that he developed a most intimate relationship with. And there are 2 aspects of that I think are important. I think that it's important for us to understand that the disciples' competitiveness came out because Jesus did that, but he didn't stop doing that. He didn't say, you're all the same. I took you three this time, but I'll take three more another time. Because there was something about Peter, James, and John that Jesus saw. Maybe it wasn't they're the favored ones as much as they needed more attention because they needed to be brought along in a deeper way. I don't know. But he clearly had a different relationship with some than the others. That doesn't mean he loved the others less. You're going to have different relationships with your children. Not all of them are going to want to do all the same things in the same way. Adjust your thinking with your children to be with each one of them what is good or necessary for each one of them. Because I have a long talk with one of my children, because I thought they needed a little bit of jacking up or being brought back on the right course, doesn't mean, okay, I've got to do the same thing with the next child when he or she reaches that same age. Now, there are some things that are going to be true like that, but I don't have to do that with every one of them in the same way. I might take one to a movie and one to a sporting event. And let my children know that we're doing that because you're different, and I know you're different, and I know what you either want or need, and I'm trying to meet those needs or wants as I understand them. That's important for us, brothers. That's true for us as grandparents or mentors. I find it interesting that Jesus thought he could rebuke Peter in such a stern way without losing him. You ever think about that? How many of us... Just think about this for a minute. How many of us would be at this congregation if Jeff or one of the elders stood up and pointed a finger at one of us and said, listen, I'm going to tell you, I'll just use Brent because he and I know each other and he won't take offense at this. But if the elders or Jeff stood up and said, Brent, you stinking devil, you better change your life and get right. How many people would say, hey, thanks, I needed that? I think a lot of people would get up and walk out and say, I'm never coming back. Yeah, the guy didn't just say I was wrong. He called me the devil. But Jesus did that with Peter. And here's what's even more astounding about that. He did that when Peter, out of the good intentions of his heart, was trying to save Jesus from himself. When Peter said, no, Lord, we won't let that happen to you. We won't let it happen to you. And Jesus responds, not by saying, oh, Peter, you misunderstand. Love your heart, brother. Love where you're at. Love what you're trying to do, but you just misunderstand. He is so brutal with Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You know, I can't imagine Peter said, oh, that's an endearing term. You know, he really loves me. He called me Satan. He didn't call any of you other guys that. And yet Peter took it. Why? I think because Jesus knew Peter could take it. I think he knew his heart. I think he knew what he could live with. And what was going to help him in that situation. To bring him up short, grab him by the collar and shake him. Because that's what Peter needed. And Jesus knew he could do that. So your children are going to be different. Boys are different than girls. I was uncomfortable at first, but I love having grandsons because it helped me see how different my granddaughters and my grandsons are. And some of that is just gender related. Let me give you one example. I was reading not too long ago about this, and this has to do largely with the way we men interact with each other. And I realized that I had been guilty of doing something I've quit doing. You can disagree with me on this. That's fine. You have a right to do that. You may find it more effective to do differently. But I've come to realize I think this is true for us. You know, when women talk, take two women, put them at a table in a restaurant, and they're excited about talking to each other. What's their position? They're face-to-face, leaning forward, as close as they can get to each other, because they are bonding. It's shooting back and forth. They are really involved. Now, put two men in that situation, see them across a room, and they're leaning forward, and they're real talking intensely. The odds are they're arguing. You know, they're in what we would say, they're in his face. Men aren't comfortable with face-to-face confrontations unless it's important for us to do that. We don't tend to operate that way. There are a few exceptions to that, but for the most part, we men want to give each other space, and we don't square our shoulders with each other. We stand side by side. We may turn to an angle, but you encounter a man who's standing right up close to you and talking right in your face, and you start getting uncomfortable. You start backing off. Why? Because that's not the way men treat men. We don't operate that way. That's an antagonistic, aggressive move on the part of a man. And we don't maintain locked eye contact unless it's conflict-oriented. Classic example, who stands toe-to-toe and stares at each other and waits for the other one to blink? Boxers. That's right. What are they doing? That's aggression. They stare. Stare them down. Look at them. I'm not blinking. I'm looking right at you. You're mine. They're sending that message. We don't do that with, I'm so glad to see you. It's good to have you here today. Welcome to Climbwood. You know, we don't do that. We don't do that. Now, let me tell you something. And when men recognize they've done something wrong, we break eye contact and look down. It is a natural response for a man. Women don't tend to do that because they're concerned about establishing the relationship. So they may be looking in your eyes and pleading with you. Men don't tend to do that. Men tend to look away when they've done the wrong thing. Now, what do we tend to do when we're correcting a boy? What do we tend to tell him? What do we always tell him? Look at me. Hey, look at me. He is responding the way males respond. He is showing his contriteness. Now, I'm not talking about staring away, looking furious. I'm not talking about that. But when a boy does something wrong and you're correcting him and he's lowered his head and he's looking down at the ground, he is telling you, I'm contrite. And we are breaking his natural tendency as a male when we say, hey, eye contact. You look at me. We think they're looking away because they're not interested. That's not the way men act. That's not the way we do when we are at business. When our boss is chewing us out for doing something wrong, where are our heads? Down. We even apologize that way. It is natural for a man when he apologizes to walk up and say, I'm really sorry. I'm not making eye contact. I'm really sorry. I blew it. We may look up and glance up to see if they're drawing a knife or something. But for the most part, we're looking away. That is what men do. And it comes back to partly our aggressiveness and competitiveness. We're not locking in. We are showing our contriteness. And I made that mistake with grandsons. I can do that with my daughters. I can say, look at me. Because that's all part of the relationship we're trying to establish or recreate. I don't do that with my grandsons now. I mean, I don't want them to ignore me. But if I'm correcting them, I don't demand they look at me. I want you to think about that. Because that's the difference in boys and girls. And when we treat them all alike, we may be exasperating our children by not understanding what they do or why they do what they do. So treat them differently and give them special opportunities that are equal to their abilities and to their desires. I like the way Jesus lowered his guard with the disciples. The way he let them see him when he was angry. They saw him when he was tired. He didn't hide that from him. And that to me is one of the greatest indicators of Jesus' Godhood. That they saw him in all of his phases and yet without sin. Never did they say, he shouldn't have acted that way. He lost it on that one. Well, chalk it up to being tired. I know he shouldn't have said that, but look, he's exhausted. In all of that, they believed him to be the Son of God. And in this, brothers, it is right for us to apologize. We get used to doing that with our wives. A friend of mine had rules of marriage, and one of them I've never forgotten is, a man can be a fool and not know it, but not if he's married. When you're married, you recognize you do things wrong, and you apologize. You learn how to apologize, but it's important for us to do that with our children. There are times we're going to lose our temper, and rather than a cursory, I'm sorry, I lost it, or the, I'm sorry, I lost it, but I did it because of this, don't put the but in there. Don't put that in there. Just apologize. Not, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, but you know I told you. Leave that out. Because the but justifies you. It makes your apology worthless. You're giving a reason why you did what you did. Don't do that. It's important to learn how to apologize to your children. You can redirect and adjust what you're doing with your children. You can say to your children, you know what, we've been doing this way, but I think probably it would be better if we tried to do this way. So from now on, we're not going to have this conflict. We're going to adjust. When you do those things, you help your children and grandchildren understand that you too are human. And you teach them that that's the way they also should redirect. Okay, and I want to close with this. There are two key areas that I think we need to concentrate on in teaching our children. Number one is the role of servant leadership, particularly to our boys, but I think our girls need to see it also. Because you want your daughters to choose a man to marry who understands servant leadership. Trust me, you want your daughters to marry a man who understands servant leadership. And so I think it's important that we teach our children that we serve them, that we lead by serving them, and not just in their earliest stages. You know, I changed your diaper when you were little, but I'm not doing anything else for you. I think it's important for us to not roll our eyes and groan when we're called upon to do something for our children, but to learn, this is part of what I am as a man. God has called me to be like Jesus Christ. What did he say about himself? Mark 10:45, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. If we're going to be like Christ, that's what we're going to do. And I think we model that in the home. I think we need to be grabbing things and helping our wives and showing our children that we do that. I think we need to be helping our children. And sometimes we may mistake teaching them independence, which is good, and mistakenly think that what we're doing is that, when in fact what we're doing is a selfish viewpoint where I just don't want to help them do what they need to have done. Servant leadership. Man, the Bible talks about it all over the place. 1 Peter 5:3, Titus 1:7, that we're not to be self-willed. Ephesians 4:11-12, that we serve to equip others. All those things are important for us. And especially that needs to be seen in the home. Symbolically, and maybe literally, we need to wash feet. I read not too long ago about a man who, with his whole family gathered, brought in a basin and got down on the floor and washed his wife's feet. Didn't say a word, just did it. Sometimes that kind of demonstrable act will remain with you the rest of your life. and the lives of your children. How you do that is up to you. But we need to demonstrate, even as Jesus did, our desire to humble ourselves, even humiliate ourselves for the sake of others. And the second, a more serious subject in some ways, is sexual roles. Our culture's rotting, and we need to teach our children their roles. I'm telling you this. I beg you, men, I beg you, do not have computers that do not have filters on them. You are begging for a body bag for yourself and for your children. And here's, let me suggest this. We were talking before about what some of us can do who don't have children in our homes. I think it'd be a magnificent gesture if somebody in this congregation said, I am willing to pay for every family that has a computer and can't afford a filter. I will pay the monthly fee or the annual fee for you to put a filtering system on your computer. I want to do that for your children. Because I'm telling you, you don't have to look for pornography to find it. And I'm telling you this, there's not a person in this room that hasn't been there. And some of us are caught in it. I will never forget the first time on my computer at work at Florida College. I thought, you know what, I don't understand the lyrics. I do not understand what the Beach Boys are saying in the song, Good Vibrations. So I just entered Good Vibrations, click. First thing that came up, I just didn't even look, click. And I was on a porn site. I turned off my screen. I called the IT people. I said, come up here. I want you to know what's here. I want you to stop this, get it off. I'll not make that mistake again. If that can happen to a grown adult, imagine how easy it is to happen to your sons and your daughters. And they're going to have a different reaction. At an early age, your daughters are going to be sickened by it. But it's going to taint their understanding of the purity of the role of sex in their lives. But for the boys, it is going to create a prurient interest in something at an unhealthy level that they will not easily get away from. Put the filters on your computers. Make sure they cannot have access to that. And I would suggest one more thing. Put the filters on so that only your wives have the codes to, and you can't bypass it. Protect yourself from those things. Because we live in a really, really sick age. And it's interesting how in Proverbs chapters 2, 5, 6, and 7, whole chapters are devoted to this subject of sexual sin with sons. Solomon says, my son, my son, my son. Chapters, not passages, are devoted to that. So it's important to do that. George Gilder, I mentioned him last night in his book, Men and Marriage, said, under normal circumstances, biology is destiny. Men and women grow up in different ways, seek different goals, transcend their biological separation chiefly through the mystery of love and marriage. He said, you know, this is biological. It's important for us to understand. This is a natural thing that we've got to curb and direct. But then he said this, let us begin with a few simple, crucial, and apparently unmentionable facts about a typical high school classroom. First and most important, most of the boys and a good number of the girls are thinking about the opposite sex most of the time. If you do not believe this, you are a dreamer. The only thing about a classroom more important to adolescent boys than whether girls are present or not is whether or not the room is on fire. I think about that passage, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. And I've said before, if that were literally true, at age 16, I'd have been a woman. Because that's what I thought about. And your boys have those urges. We all do, and God put them in us. But He wants us to channel those and to make sure we understand that. Talk with your sons. Tell them about these things. Caution them about going to their friends' houses and watching things there. I have a good friend whose sons went to stay with friends, good friends. He thought good homes. And the boys all got apart and started bringing up things that were ungodly. His sons were tainted by that. Talk to your children about those things. And then your girls. I've said to men who have daughters, and I know a number of you have said, I have daughters too. I'm going to tell you this. Shower your daughters with physical, verbal affection. Shower them with that. Hope that they don't reach a point where that becomes uncomfortable for them. Hold them in your laps as small girls. Hug them and kiss them on the forehead as teenagers. Be careful about doing that out in public if that embarrasses them, but for some girls it doesn't. But you got to shower them with that because they crave that physical, emotional, verbal affection. And if they don't get it from you, they will find a male who does give it to them. And they may not be as purely motivated as you are. You've got to do that. And it's important, I think. The viewpoint I have of Song of Songs was the one I first learned from Homer Haley and Bob Owen, and it is that story is not about a man and his wife. It's about a three-person situation with a girl who's involved with a boy who has a pure love for her and a jaded king who just wants her in his stable of beauties. And when you take that view of it, there are some things that are said in Song of Songs that become very beautiful. I urge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it awakens. The idea of that being that you can't hurry or force love. That you've got to let it develop, and that it develops out of friendship. I love the way the Shulamite girl says of her shepherd boy, "This is my beloved, this is my friend." Man, that's a beautiful statement. Teach your girls to fall in love with people who are friends, to be motivated by that. It's about loyalty and companionship, not sensuality. Teach them to be chaste, C-H-A-S-T-E, not chaste, C-H-A-S-E-D. Teach them that's what it's about. Well, there's so much more I could say, but I'm going to quit. I'm stopping here. And I think we're supposed to take a short break, and then we'll come back together and maybe talk together about some things you have questions about or challenges to some things I've said. I certainly would welcome that, and some of the other brothers might really enjoy and benefit from hearing a counter view of some of these things. I'd be glad to entertain it. Thanks for listening, brothers. We'll stand adjourned for a few moments.